Family Room Podcast, where I, Peter Squires, get to know your friends and neighbors. My family, they never know. My family, they never know.
My family. Welcome to the Family Room Podcast, getting to know your friends and neighbors. I'm Peter Squires. My guest on this episode is Lincoln Soldati. Lincoln is a retired attorney, the former mayor of Somersworth, and a sometime Uber driver, among other things. We discussed military service, mentorship, running for office, adjusting when life throws you curveballs, and Lincoln's recent participation in the resistance against the Dakota Access Pipeline and Standing Rock, among other things. Thanks for listening. Enjoy. You lived in Somersworth previously, and now you live in Portsmouth, right?
That's true.
Where did you grow up?
Well, I grew up in Portsmouth and Exeter. Lived in Portsmouth until I was 10. Grew up at Wentworth Acres. I don't know if you're familiar with Portsmouth's history at all, but anyway, Wentworth Acres was a it was like a post World War II government. Housing project geared towards returning vets that had families. And it's now the location of where it was is where Osprey Landing is in Portsmouth. I don't know if you know that, but anyway, that's the physical location of where it was. I think some of the buildings that are there were rehabbed from the old, although the entire complex is not there now. But anyway, and they were asbestos shingled buildings.
Nice. You
know? I mean, literally, you know, the gray brittle shingles was the outside. We used to pop them off and use them as frisbees before there were frisbees. But there was Wentworth Acres School that was that, you know, served the Acres, which was actually a great school, and that's now gone. It years ago it had been I think the Portsmouth Christian Academy, and then now I think it's a like a ball field or something. So anyway, so when we were 10, we moved. My parents bought their first home, and we moved to Exeter. And I lived in Exeter until I went away to college and then the service and all of that. So that's where I grew up. I went to St. Thomas for high school, you know, which was so we would commute from Exeter every day to Dover. Then I went to University of Notre Dame for my undergraduate. Got drafted in 1969.
Wow.
Did 1 year, 11 months, and 28 days in the Army.
Wow.
But who's counting, right? went back to Notre Dame at that point, finished my undergraduate, and then I went to law school in New Hampshire. And that's, you know, so that was sort of my early history.
Wow. So was your dad a vet?
Oh, yes. My dad, he was in, I think it was B-24s in World War II. He was a flight engineer and turret gunner, mainly stationed in Italy. He flew over Anzio and a number of other. He had like 62 flight missions. You're only supposed to do, I can't remember what the number was, but, you know, there was a cap for how many flights you were supposed to do. And you know, that sort of was a meaningless cap, but he ended up with 62. I used to have a flight jacket of his, and they had like these little decals for each mission. So, yeah, he was a vet, had a Purple Heart. So sure.
Wow. Yeah. So is Soldati an Italian name?
It is an Italian name, and it translates as soldiers.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So I wonder what that must have felt like, you know?
Well, I think he had mixed feelings about it, to be honest with you. And it's funny, back in the early 70s, I took a – well, I spent a summer in Spain taking Spanish classes because I just couldn't do the labs. So I made a deal and got credit by going to Spain and learning Spanish. Not that I remember a word of it, but anyway. And I went to Italy when I was done, you know, just traveled around a little bit. Went to my grandfather's hometown, you know, where my grandfather was from, and actually, you know, stayed in the house that he built and met my relatives, everything else. Wow. And there was a very old Italian lady who was my great great aunt or whatever, and she asked which, because my father was from a fairly large family, there were a number of brothers. And she asked which of the brothers, because they had some knowledge of the family in America. And she asked, which of the brothers bombed Parma, because Parma was the capital of the province they lived in. And so I had to tell them it was my dad.
Wow.
You know, but they were fine with that because they understood it was what ultimately ended up liberating Italy. So,
wow.
Yeah, it was. He did bomb his ancestry.
You know, you don't really ever. I guess ever think about those sort of like personalized stories of war. You know, like that they knew that one of their relatives had participated on both. I don't know, like just understanding it in that personal way, the bomber, the city, the nations involved. It's, I don't know. I think I'm born in 1981. So my experience with war is just completely detached. You know, like my generation never had a draft. So like if you didn't want to be involved with the military, you just didn't have to,
right.
You know? And I've never really had to think about war in such a personal way. You know, it's just sort of a thing that I in fact oppose, but it's like previous generations didn't have that choice to make, you know?
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, while, I have somewhat ambivalent feelings about the draft, particularly having been, if you will, a victim of the draft. But at the same time, I'm not sure that we haven't lost something by having, I guess what they refer to as an all volunteer, army or services, because it does allow, I think, the vast majority of people to sort of be disconnected from and issues of, you know, war and peace are not as personal. They're not as front and center. They're not something that back in, of course, you know, I view myself as a child of the 60s, so to speak. You know, I was born in 1949, just to give you a perspective there. But people had to confront it. Or at least confront the possibility, you know, particularly during, you know, obviously Vietnam was a very turbulent time in this country, but, and I don't know anybody that was neutral, you know,
right.
At that time.
Yeah.
So, you know, people had to confront, issues of war and peace and how it affected them directly. And I think that, today it's removed from that. I mean, it's gotten to the point, and particularly with things such as, you know, drone warfare, mm-hmm. you know, it's like a video game. It's that detached.
Yeah.
And so now obviously for those that are in countries in which wars are going on, you know, the people there live it daily. I mean, it's their reality. But for the rest of the world, or much of the world, you know, people are completely divorced from it. They don't have any sense of it. And so while, you know, I wasn't a huge fan of the draft, I do think that it made a greater portion, almost all of the population, at least think about these issues that surround war and peace. And we're so divorced from it now, it seems to me. And I think I don't think that's a good thing. I think that allows us to have views that are not just not well informed by experience.
Yeah. And it's such a different kind of learning to actually see something firsthand than it is to just read about it or hear about it or hear someone else's opinion about it or, you know, have to decide whose opinion you trust about something and whose you don't, as opposed to actually being there or confronting the possibility that you'll be there.
Yeah. And I think the fact that you have to confront it because it may involve you or your family is really what makes it important overall, because it's not just an academic exercise, because it can be very real. And I think you think about it differently as a result.
Yeah. When we were on our trip that we just got back from, I found myself thinking in a more personalized way about the wars of the past in a way that, you know, it's just, they were just subjects in a history book to me before, with, you know, like World War II was like somewhat personalized. Like my mother was named after like a family member who was lost in the Holocaust, but it was still far enough removed that I never thought of it as something that, I don't know, it just seemed really far away. I think maybe just because the footage you see of it is in black and white, and it's like, well, that's all the long past to me, you know. But then you're there and it's like, oh, this was not long ago at all. And you see kind of the political parallels these days, and it's like, wow, this is really not long ago, and why wouldn't something like this be possible again under similar conditions? And it's just, I don't know, it just got me thinking about history. Being in the places where important things have happened got me thinking about history in a different way, more in a personal way, in a less in a sort of big picture, sort of like a game of risk kind of a way. It's more like, wow, this is how these individuals were affected.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So after, when you came back from Vietnam, and then you went to law school, and then you came...
Well, let me just say, I didn't actually go to Vietnam.
Oh.
I had, and it was just pure happenstance. I mean, you know, I was, as I say, in the Army, but I had sort of a... There was just a series of events that happened originally because of some, you know, you get tested when you go in the Army, you know, physical tests, academic tests, all kinds of tests, and aptitude tests, everything else. So anyway, so after the test, I qualified for something called warrant officer flight, which are either fixed plane or more commonly helicopter pilots. They're all, it's called warrant officers. A lot of people don't even know the term. You know, they know sergeant. They know colonel, they know, you know, all the other terms, but warrant officer is like sort of a separate, and those are the pilots in the Army. So I qualified for warrant officer flight, and I'd always wanted to learn how to fly, which later on as a civilian, I actually got a pilot's license, but that's a different story. But so what happened was, there was a group of us that qualified. Originally, we were at Fort Dix, and normally that, you know, we'd be doing, because I was from New England, you'd do your basic training here. But those of us who qualified for this warrant officer flight, we got sent to Fort Polk, Louisiana for basic training. So I did my basic training at Fort Polk, Louisiana, which was also the military training ground for what they call Tigerland, which was the Vietnam infantry training post, because the climate in Louisiana was most mirrored that in Vietnam. So the training for the infantry largely was at Fort Polk as well. But anyway, so I was going to go to warrant officer flight, and then when we finished basic training, we were put in what's called a holdover status, because the schools, and the schools for flight training are quite long. They're among the longest trainings that they have. It's like, I don't know if it's 26 weeks or what it is, but it's a very long training process. So there are only a few available slots. And this was during what was often referred to as the Vietnamization of the war, which was a period in which we began training South Vietnamese army or military to higher skills. So there were all these South Vietnamese that were over here being trained as helicopter and fixed wing pilots. So the schools were filled up. So we got delayed. We had to wait until the schools opened up and got put in a holdover status. And it was so long that it was nearly a year before the school opened up. So, and of course, by that time, you're having your army experience, shall we say. And at the end of that period, once you go through the school like that, you then have to re-up or re-enlist, or not enlist because I was drafted. But anyway, you then have to commit to a three-year commitment. Wow. And so I'd already had a year in at that point, and then it's like, gee, do I really want to do another 3 years with this experience that I've had? And so I eventually opted out and said, no, so I declined the school. Well, then they didn't quite know what to do with me. And eventually I got sent to, for another reason, but I got sent to Fort Hood, Texas, which is with the 2nd Armored Division, which was Patton's old unit. But because Fort Hood's a huge armor, it's like the largest armored base in the country. And I went through a variety of potential jobs in the Army there. I was a tank driver. I was a cook. I was anyway, a number of things. My time just sort of wore out before I was given an MOS that would then assign me. So it was just happenstance that that I didn't end up to go to Vietnam. Although at Fort Hood, we had a lot of people returning from Vietnam. As a everyone who had been in armor in Vietnam came back to Fort Hood. So I didn't actually go to Vietnam, which is unusual for the period. Yeah. But that's just the way it happened.
Very lucky.
In some respects, yes.
Yeah.
There were times when I wish I had gone and not dealt with what I had to deal with the Army. But anyway, that's a whole other story.
Wow. Wow.
I did realize fairly early on that just personality-wise, I was not really military material. The chain of command in my mind left a lot to be desired. So and I was basically a private my whole career, so I wasn't it was an interesting experience, but not one I'd want to repeat, let's put it that way. Although I certainly I didn't when I got my notice, I didn't run off to Canada. I didn't do a lot of other options that I could have, and I'd been active and I was active among my peers in anti-war activities. Some I think thought that I would have done something like that, but I didn't. Both in part because, I just felt that abiding by the law was important, even as I protested against a lot of aspects of what the government was doing. But although that didn't actually work well for me while I was in the military. Wow. I continued to be opposed to the war. So not a view that was common within the military, although people would be surprised. There was a pretty active anti-war movement within the military.
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine that would be the case because of the draft. That they were bringing people in regardless of their stance.
Well, so you ended up with a very diverse, both in terms of viewpoints and, but also skills. I mean, you had, as I say, it was an interesting experience, but not one I'd wish on anyone.
Yeah.
But wow. my son just spent 6 years, and obviously he wasn't drafted. He was in the 82nd Airborne down at Fort Bragg. Originally, he thought about staying in for a lot longer, but he was in for 6 years. And Primarily, he went in because of college debt, you know, which of course is an issue that many, many young people face these days. And, you know, he was able to have his debt paid for as a result. And now he's in law school. Actually, he's doing a combination law degree and MBA. So all of which is paid by the GI Bill. So,
wow.
You know, and actually his wife as well was in the military. So she's actually still in the reserves, but... And is also going to law school. So, I mean, it's like, it's interesting. But,
yeah, I mean. You
know, history repeats itself,
yeah,
so to speak.
And there is something, you know, for, it's a different level of civil engagement, you know, and of, you know, really putting your beliefs on the line in the most stark of terms, yeah. You know. And I think that, yeah, I can see how there would be. That there would be positive benefit or positive outcome from that in some ways, for sure. And to get to see on the personal level that, you know, they're able to do things now as a result of having served that they may not have otherwise.
Yeah, and he got to jump out of airplanes.
That too. So then what did you do after you were out and got to be a civilian again?
Well, I went back to Notre Dame, finished my undergraduate degree, then went to law school here in New Hampshire, our first and only law school. But I was happy to get back to New Hampshire. I mean, I just think it's an incredible state. But so I went to law school, and when I first got out, I worked for Police Standards and Training Council, which is the police training arm or academy. It's like the police academy is run by Police Standards. So that was the first job I had out of law school. And then I ended up, once I passed the bar, I ended up hanging a shingle in Concord because we were living up in Warner in that area of the state. And hung a shingle and worked for a while, and then was hired by Joe Netto, who had a law practice in Dover. He was at the time also a district court judge in Durham, eventually became a Superior Court judge, and then eventually a Supreme Court judge. Wow. So great man, and was a real mentor to me early in my career, and so I was always very thankful to have had that experience. And so after, actually, once he got appointed to Superior Court, he had to sell his practice. And I sort of got sold with the furniture, if you will. You know, I don't think that I would have chosen the partners that ended up buying the practice. I probably wouldn't have chosen to apply for them for a job. But as I said, it sort of was like it was just part of the deal. So the staff pretty much went over. But after a short while there, I recognized this isn't really what I want to be doing. And I was approached by Fred Catalfa. I don't know if you know or knew Fred Catalfa. He just passed away this past year at 99 or something. Anyway, he was a real character within the bar, the New Hampshire bar. You know, he had been practicing since the late 40s, and was just a real character and beloved by anyone who knew Freddie. I mean, he was just an amazing character and a very good lawyer. And he had in the late 40s, early 50s, been county attorney in Stratford County, which is where we were living at the time. And he approached me about running for county attorney and said I should think about it. So I thought about it. I said, gee, that, you know. And I and one of the reasons that was significant for me is that my interest was criminal law, even though when I'd practiced in a variety of legal fields or sort of, you know, did a little of this, little of that. My real interest was criminal law. So I thought, and so I was doing some criminal defense, not a lot, but a little bit. And I interacted as a result with the county attorney's office, and I was not happy with the way the county attorney's office was run. So when Freddie approached me about it, I eventually said, yeah, I think this is a good idea. Of course, it's an elected position. You have to run for county office. You know, which I hadn't done, certainly not in New Hampshire, you know, since student council in high school or something, you know. So, and Freddie was great. I mean, he mapped out the whole campaign, you know, said, this is how you do it. This is blah, blah, blah. And so I ran against the incumbent in the primary. And actually that was when I sort of formally became a Democrat was then, because, you know, you got to run in a party. And Stafford County was one of the few Democratic parties in the state at the time. And, so it made sense, but of course it meant running against an incumbent, which is a tough thing to do, particularly low on the ballot, because nobody even knows what the county attorney does, you know? So, you know, so it's hard to sort of get traction, but, you know, I knocked on every door I could. I mean, every day I was just out. You know, I worked hard in that campaign, met a lot, ton of people, and found I really enjoyed, you know, the whole process. As it happened, I won the primary. And then in the general, it really was a lot easier. So, and but won the general and started as county attorney. And I went on to run for 9 terms, and I was there for almost 18 years. Wow. And and it was fabulous. I loved the job, I learned I was good at it, you know, which was helpful. And I felt I was able to make a lot of positive impact, not just locally, not just within the county, but I got very much involved in a lot of issues statewide. We were doing things with on sexual assault cases, child abuse cases that, you know, people today are talking about as being innovative. Well, we were doing that, gosh, now, you know, 30 years ago. You know, I was very proud of my time as county attorney, prosecuted a lot of cases, kept a full caseload myself, hired a lot of great people, had wonderful people working for me, tremendous staff. And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it a lot. The only reason eventually that I left, because I could, on one side of my recollection, I could have stayed there, and I felt I could have continued with that for a long time. Not that 18 years isn't a long time, but it really became, you know, I have 4 kids. So as they got older and they start applying for schools, and, you know, whether it be private schools for high school or whether they're going to colleges, the need to increase my income became an issue. And I felt the only way I could do that was in the private practice, because being county attorney was a great job, but financially it wasn't a way you were going to be able to afford, you know, college for 4 kids. So that was an impetus to then leave. And so I made one phone call. I made one phone call to somebody I'd gone to law school with. It was a very successful criminal defense attorney. Actually, we'd had a lot of cases together over the years. But he seemed to know how to address the financial aspects of the practice of law in criminal defense. And so I made a phone call for him, made a suggestion, and joined forces, and that was that. So, and then went on to do criminal defense until the day I retired. So,
wow. So how long were you doing? Were you doing that before you retired?
Well, that was in 2000. So, I did that. Well, I retired in January of 2017. So I did that for 17 years.
Wow.
And then the other sort of remaining years, both before and after, were a combination of other types of things. But so for the most part, half my career was as a prosecutor and half as a defense attorney.
So that must have sort of helped, and one must have helped inform the other, right?
Well, certainly. Yeah. I think that, I mean, what do they call a former prosecutor? A defense attorney, you know, so, but I think it was helpful to have both experiences. I think being a prosecutor made me a better defense attorney, and I'd done defense work before I became a prosecutor, so not as intensely and not as exclusively, and I think that helped inform me and made me a better prosecutor as well. So I think it's beneficial and important for attorneys that are in one, because one of the problems that I see within the legal profession and its approach to criminal issues is people, I know a lot of prosecutors that view their job in ideological and or political terms, which I always felt was a huge mistake. First of all, you're not there to promote an ideology. You're there to do justice. The advantages as a prosecutor that you have that a defense attorney doesn't have is you get to choose your cases. You know, you get to make the decisions about who you're going to prosecute and cases that you're not going to. And those decisions should be, and I believe have to be made on the basis of the evidence that supports them. They should not be based upon some ideological preconceived notion there are some very horrible crimes that people commit, but you can't lose sight of the case, and the case is about evidence. It's not about this is a good person, this is a bad person. You know, people use all this rhetoric about, oh, this evil and this, you know, well, yeah, there are some pretty dangerous people in the world some people that commit crimes are in fact dangerous. But in my experience, it strikes me that the vast majority of crime falls into a few categories. And one of the biggest categories is just stupidity. Hmm. You know, there's some stupid people out there that are doing things that are just stupid. So that is a certain percentage of crime that's just pure stupidity. You know, and then, of course, people have motives, whatever, and people react. You know, one of the things that I always understood is that, you know, we're all people, we're all human beings. And it struck me that, I mean, there were people I prosecuted. I mean, I prosecuted priests and sexual assaults. There was a fellow who was very revered, had been a mayor in Dover, was awarded Citizens of the Year by the Rotary or, you know, other chamber of commerce, whatever. You know, there are people that were highly respected, you know, that I prosecuted for very serious charges, child molestation. And if you step back and you look at these things, you know, you could, you know, some people want to demonize everybody. That's, this idea, oh, somebody's a criminal. Well, you know, people make decisions at points in their lives, and a lot of times they make bad decisions, and some of those decisions end up being crimes. The fact of the matter is, we're all people, every one of us, you know, we're human beings, and we all have the same capacity. And what I mean by that is that we are all capable of anything that another human being is capable of. Now, there may be limitations on those capabilities. I mean, you get in certain areas where, you know, it takes some skill to do certain things. Well, if you don't have those skills, you know. But in terms of human behavior, we're all, we're the same. We're human, you know. So I always felt it was inappropriate to demonize people. You have a job to do. You have to uphold the law. You have to prosecute people based upon the facts and the evidence, but not based on some demonization of other humans and, thinking that you're better than they are or whatever. And, you know, because then that leads you down the path of classifying people because of this or that characteristic. I mean, I always viewed the job not as a political job, but as a professional job. And I did love the job. You know, it was great.
It must give you, I mean, I think that that's a good outlook on the people around you in general, is everyone makes mistakes. Everyone deserves to have their side of the story said, and everyone deserves a chance, you know? And so that must affect your outlook in some ways in a positive way, that like, oh, give them a break, you know, or let's hear them out. And on the other hand, that sort of like, man, people are stupid.
I mean, there were cases that you just had to laugh. You know, you're like, what could this person be thinking? You know, you know, so in many ways, it was an experience of encountering human behavior, mm-hmm. that spanned a great spectrum of humanity. You know, and of course, you know, the other side of it is, you know, you were dealing with oftentimes victims of some pretty horrific conduct, and you also developed an empathy and a compassion and a way to a champion for people who sometimes aren't, you know, and not all victims are sort of, you know, purely innocent and sympathetic. You know, there are people who are victims who have had rough lives themselves and have had difficult challenges and therefore are not always their cases are tougher, much tougher, you know, much more difficult, but they deserve our efforts and our compassion and our approach to, again, if they're victims of crime, that they deserve us to stand up and assist them in prosecuting those crimes. So it's an interesting, I mean, it's been an interesting profession, one that I was always very proud of, still am. And, whether it was a very, very serious crime or, you know, a lesser crime, I think the area where I had some reservations, and of course, that a lot of times when I would focus on the policy of criminal justice is when I would try to influence things, whether it be testifying in the legislature or working on a task force that, certainly changing the psychology and the around domestic violence. I am old enough and practiced at a time when domestic violence, you know, police would go to a scene of domestic violence, which unquestionably is the most dangerous setting that most police encounter. But there was a time when, you know, the attitude was, you know, the officer would arrive and, basically just tell everybody, oh, well, you know, stop this, whatever.
Break it up, yeah.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, we went from that to mandatory arrest systems and the same was true when I first started in sexual assault cases. I mean, you know, the way that victims would be treated by law enforcement, and indeed the whole system, I mean, it was, they would just be re-victimized. And child abuse the same way. It took years to educate the legislature, the public, the police, the whole system, really. We have a lot of systems now in place that that are meant to minimize the re-traumatization of victims and so forth. So, you know, it's been an interesting process. But I always did view one area that I thought where we were just getting the whole system wrong, and that was in drug prosecutions. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's gotten better over the years, but, you know, there was a time when, you know, people were prosecuted for what at least I would view as fairly minor offenses. And they would, you know, be sentenced to severe sentences that people who committed violent crimes wouldn't be getting, you know.
Were there mandatory minimums in place?
Well, not so much in New Hampshire. There's only a few areas where that was the case. Of course, then you get into the federal system, which I have to say I was so disenchanted with the I got to a point, and this is when I was doing defense work, where I stopped doing federal criminal defense work. It was just depressing. The I mean, you would just see these lives ruined. And you know, one of the saddest cases was a young man who was very, very bright, didn't have a lot of education, but I love this guy. His name was Carlos, and he was being prosecuted federally for sale and a few other things, but the at the time. See, we used to think that the federal guidelines were mandatory, and it wasn't until years later that the court says, the Supreme Court finally says, oh, no, these aren't mandatory. These are just guidelines. You know, it's like, so we're all like hitting ourselves in the heads, going, what? So, because for years they were treated as mandatory sentencing provisions. And even once they became guidelines, they still or were recognized as simply guidelines. You know, they still, you know, the history was there. So for the most part, they were often. But you would get these cases occasionally where, you know, based on the federal guidelines, somebody's ending up with a 25 to life sentence for a drug offense, and you're like, why? You know, why is this? So this guy Carlos that I represented along with my partner at the time, and. I really liked this kid. You know, he had no education whatsoever, but he was so smart. And he used to, of course, I loved because I was an English major. He used to quote me Chaucer all the time, you know? And he would ask me questions about Chaucer, and I thought, gee, what a potential this, you know, if this young man had simply had. You know, the opportunities to get a formal education, to get the credentials or whatever. You know, there's no telling what. I mean, he could have done wonderful, great things, I'm sure. I mean, he was just so bright. But for him and the environment that he, grew up in, the best opportunity for him to survive and to thrive was in the, the drug environment, unfortunately. So, and his case was virtually unwinnable. It was just, tried to convince him to, we had worked a deal. It's not a great deal, but it was a good deal. He just wouldn't, you know, he kept saying, oh, you're the best, you're the best. I was like, please don't say that. You know, this isn't going to go well. So we ended up trying the case. And of course, in the federal system, if you tried the case, you got punished for trying it. You know, so the worst thing to be, in my view, in the federal system is to be an innocent person. Because if you're an innocent person and you try the case and you're convicted, you know, you're going to be punished for it. It's just outrageous. But anyway, that's just a particular viewpoint. But so I stopped doing, there's one silver lining in Carlos's case, and that is that, so he got like 25-year sentence.
Wow.
And very sad. And a couple of years ago, when Obama had directed the Justice Department to, take a look at some of these, his sentence got commuted.
Wow!
And he was released. Did a lot of time, but because this was many years ago, but. So I was glad finally he did get out. But that was it. After that case, I said, I can't participate in this. It just seemed ridiculous to me.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, and then at some point in this whole period of your life, you were also the mayor of Somersworth, right?
Well, towards the end of that, yes. I was mayor for a brief period of time because then our house burned down and then that changed everything. But and I do have to say that being the mayor in Somersworth was probably the best job I've ever had. I just absolutely loved it. And which was interesting because I would have people approach me and say, oh, geez, must be terrible. Everyone comes to you and they're complaining about this, that, and that. And I'm like, no, you don't understand. People are great. And I said, and the other thing is that, yes, people come to me and ask me this, but they also understand. I mean, we have a city manager form of government in Summersworth. And so the mayor, you know, he presides over the city council. He votes in case of a tie. He makes appointments, that sort of thing. But by and large, it's more of a ceremonial, you know, you're not running the city day to day. That's what the city manager is doing. But you did have the ability, first of all, to influence both the tone and the dialogue in the city. And, of course, since you preside over the city council, you know, you have some influence within that context as well. But the best thing about being mayor, I mean, not only was it one of the best jobs I ever had, it also was one of the easiest because it was, you know, there's an old Woody Allen line that 90% of life is just showing up. Well, nothing could be truer for the position of mayor. And what I was not, what I hadn't anticipated and what I found absolutely the best thing about it is that it mattered to people. It made a difference to people that the mayor shows up. Hmm. You know, I mean, I used to think, you know, because, and so once this sort of dawned on me, you know, I said, well, geez, this is the easy thing to do, you know? So, you know, I would do like, I don't know if it was Thursdays or what day of the week it was. Of course, I had the advantage of being at that point self-employed. I had opened my own office in Summersworth. And so, you know, I really didn't have to answer to anyone else. I mean, obviously if I was in court or something like that, but beyond that, I was my own boss. So that was a great advantage because, for example, like Thursday afternoon at 3 o'clock, during the fall, for example, in winter, the freshman basketball team would have their games, right? Or the both the boys and the girls or whatever, alternate whatever days. And of course, you know, 10 people show up at these games. Well, I would look at the clock and say, oh, okay. So I'd go over to the gym. And I would go to these games. And of course, I wouldn't just go to the freshman games, but I'd go to the JV games, and I also go to the varsity games. Of course, you know, people would go to the varsity games. Very few people go to the JV games, and nobody was at the freshman games. But they were great. I mean, the kids were just fabulous because, you know, they didn't. I mean, a few had some skills, but for the most part, these were pretty funny games. But it was the fact that the mayor was at the game made a difference to people, you know. Mm-hmm. So I found that I would end up going to things that I never would have attended ever in my normal existence. And it was wonderful because that in turn enabled me to meet people in my own community that I never would have met otherwise, that I never would have had contact with. And you know, I mean, we all have our sort of very secluded lives. You know, we might not think of it that way, but we do. We have a set of friends, we have a set of activities. We tend to do the same things. So, you know, for example, I would go to, you know, we would have these winter fests, and you could have breakfast with Frosty. It's a good example. And, well, I would never go to breakfast with Frosty, you know, typically, you know. But, of course, as the mayor, it's like, hey, I got to go to breakfast with Frosty. And it was wonderful because I would meet these young families, mostly were at that type of event, you know, that people I never would have met in my normal everyday activities. And they were great. And, of course, they were thrilled that you were there, not because of me, but because I was the mayor.
Right.
You know, I mean, that was the thing I used to say to people. I said, well, you know, I don't get it. I'm the same schmuck I was the day before, but now it seems to make
no,
a difference.
No, now you have a special hat.
Yeah, a special hat, exactly. And that really was the joy. It was the joy of meeting people in my own community. And people, you know, they would come up and they would have questions and they might have an issue, whatever. And, you know, most of the time there really wasn't much directly that you could do, but the fact that you would listen to their issue and occasionally you actually could do something. But even when they knew there wasn't anything that you personally could do, the fact that you would take the time and listen to them made a difference. It affected them in ways, in very positive ways. Mm. The other thing that was important to me was the notion of civil discourse. Mm. The reason I ended up running for mayor, the most significant reason, the thing that really propelled me to go and do this, was the it's sort of reminiscent of today in some ways. But the within our city, the meetings, like the public meetings, the city council meetings, and so forth, the public was discouraged from participating, actively discouraged mm-hmm. by members of the council and the former mayor, and I found that offensive because. You know, it is government, you know, for the people, by the people, of the people, you know,
right.
It's the people. It's not the office holders that are right. important. And to discourage people, you know, if you're a decision maker and your job is to make decisions on things that affect people's lives, it's kind of important to listen to the people whose lives you're affecting, right. you know. And, you know, some of these people have great ideas. Hey, some of them have crazy ideas, but whether crazy or not, you know, if you don't hear an idea, you don't know it. You know, right. you're not exposed to it. You don't have the opportunity to act on it. So one of my things about being mayor was to encourage people to come. And I would tell people, I would say, look, we want your input. We want to know what your ideas are. So please come. Please participate. Even if we have disagreements, that's okay. I mean, we have some characters like any community. We had some characters in Somersworth, and you know, I remember this one guy who probably on every single issue I could think of, I was probably politically at the opposite end of the spectrum. He was one of the few people that actually would come and would be vocal. And I would always welcome him, and I would always acknowledge him and thank him for his input. And and it didn't matter that, you know, maybe I didn't agree with the ideas. The fact that here's a guy that's willing to come out there, put himself on the line, share his views, I thought that was great, and I thought that was important because you know, even if you aren't going to buy that idea, maybe it gives you a little bit of pause. Maybe it gives you a moment to say, well, gee, maybe he has a point on this, and so maybe I should rethink, you know. That's the whole point of what our country and the idea of civil discourse, that's what it's about. That's what yeah. it's supposed to be about. So that was one of the most important issues for me, you know, because it's not like I was going to run and I'm going to, you know, promote some bill within the city council that's going to do this, that, or the other thing, because, hey, the mayor, you only vote when there's a tie anyway. But you do have the opportunity to influence the way people view things. Mm-hmm. You have an opportunity to have an impact in other ways, if not directly on legislative issues, but on a much broader and in some ways, sometimes even a more significant way. So I just loved it. It was the best thing I've ever done. You know, and at the time, you know, I thought, oh, gosh, I'm going to do this forever. I'll just, you know, I love this. I love the people in this community, and I know how to work hard, and I know how to campaign and all that. So, but then, of course, the universe had other plans. We had made deliberate choices to, you know, when I left the firm I was with in Portsmouth and I came, I opened my own practice in Somersworth, decided to run for mayor, all that. I really sort of had this view of what our future, it was a commitment to our house, which was a wonderful, beautiful, lovely, lovely Queen Anne. It was part of the community in many respects. You know, so I thought that was our future, you know, and, you know, Kathleen and I used to talk about, you know, she's, when we first bought the house, Kathleen's my wife, you know, she said, oh, this is the house I want to die in, you know, and that was sort of what we thought the future, but, you know, life has other plans for you, yeah. and, you know, so and we learned, you know, as tragic as the fire was, and it was tragic, you know, there's a lot of lessons we learned from it, both about life, but also about many other things. And so it changed our lives, you know, as we say.
Well, it must have. I mean, it's we're always constantly reminded that sort of the farther down the road you plan, the more, you know, curveballs will get thrown in the way. Wow, that must have been an enormous one. So you had to stop being mayor because you left Summersworth.
Yes, because you have to live in you have to live in the town if you're, you know. I mean, we thought about rebuilding at the time. We thought we were going to rebuild, in fact, and you know, we actually were living at a house just a few houses down. You know, after the fire, we were. Somebody who had a house on the hill and they were, you know, trying to sell it, and they offered it to us to rent until we got our house. So we thought we were going to rebuild, you know, and then of course after about 6 months of going down that road, we started getting the figures in for the cost, you know. And if you're your house is interesting because if you're thinking about building a Queen Anne Victorian in the 21st century. And of course it was a spectacular house, you know, I mean, it had the circular turrets, it had all the bump outs, it had stained glass windows, it had, elaborate woodworking, just a beautiful house, slate roof. I mean, you know, it was an architectural, treasure. You know, so trying to rebuild that, it's hard to do it on the cheap in the 21st century. So we reached a point where we realized that the house would not be worth what it cost to build.
Yeah.
Not only in our lifetimes, but probably our children's lifetime. Now part of that was the location. You know, Summersworth's, you know, was not a great real estate market. So anyway, it just made no sense economically. And once we accepted that, then we could move on. I think it was Kathleen at one point said, you know, we need to stop looking in the rearview mirror. You know, it was like getting hit by a lightning bolt. It's like, you're absolutely correct. We need to look to the future, you know, because our lives had changed. I mean, all our kids were grown and out and doing their own thing. And most of them were halfway, well, not halfway, all the way across the country. We had three kids that live in California now. So, you know, so it really was the two of us, you know, and here was this huge house. And, you know, we realized, well, when there's two of us, there's about 750 square feet we live in. We never go on the third floor. We don't, you know, there's like two rooms on the second floor and kitchen and living room. That's it. We're not using the rest of this house. So, you know, that's when we began to think differently about the future and what our choice, our opportunities were. So.
It's hard letting go of just that, the feeling of home in a place, you know, all your memories are there and all your stuff is there. And, you know, in a, I guess in a situation like that, the decision is sort of just made for you. And then you have to get practical, but it's hard to change when you've had a certain image in mind of how things are going to go. Yeah. It's hard to just, you know, it's like wiping a chalkboard clean.
Well, you know, you mentioned stuff. I mean, one of the lessons, I mean, it was just the amount of stuff we had. It was, you know, this was a three-story house plus a full basement and a garage. The amount of stuff that we had collected over 30 years, because that's about how long we were there. It was just astronomical. It just, you know, and of course, you know, when something like this happens, one of the things you have to do with insurance is, you know, you have to itemize literally every single thing that you owned or that was in the house, you know, which was in and of itself was an enormous task. But the other thing that you realize is ultimately it's just stuff, you know, and you realize you then realize there's a lot of stuff you don't need, and you can get by with a lot less. So that was one of the positive lessons, and plus becoming less attached to stuff, you know, was an important, and recognizing that, I mean, everyone was safe. Nobody got injured or hurt, and none of the animals were hurt. All the kids were fine. Everybody was fine. Nobody was injured. That was really the important part. The rest of it was just stuff. The house itself was a loss because, you know, it was a historic architectural home. It was, it played a role in the community as well. It really was a gathering place for many people, and particularly the Hill. It was a magnet for a lot of events and things. But you know, but that sense of community carried on elsewhere afterwards, which was great to see that as well. But so yeah, but it is life changing, you know, an event like that, and you know, but there's a lot of positive as well as the sad parts of it. But so it was an event.
Yeah,
no question.
So I wanna hear a little bit about your sort of post retirement life, because it's I've heard about it through Kathleen primarily. You know, your decision to work as an Uber driver, and also your decision to go to join the fight at Standing Rock.
Well, actually that the Standing Rock obviously occurred before I retired, but, although I'd been thinking of it for some time. And of course my view is once you begin to think about retiring, you're retired. I mean, there's, you know, cause it says something about really where your mindset is and where your psyche is. But so, let's see where to begin. Well, let me get rid of the Uber thing first, okay? Because in some ways that's the easiest thing. So, and let me talk. Well, we'll come back to Standing Rock, because that's sort of a thing unto itself. But so let me talk a little bit about retirement. So I retired in January, January 1st, after roughly 40 years in of being a trial lawyer, and primarily in criminal work, criminal law. So. And the real reason I decided to retire was not related so much to the practice of law, because I love practicing law. I particularly love trial work. The you know, my the thing I love the best is standing up in front of 12 strangers and convincing them that I'm correct on some point of law. I mean, it just, it's when my adrenaline would get flowing. It's when whatever skills I may have, which may not be a lot, but whatever they were, that was when they would come on display. It was the one thing in my life that I felt confident about in terms of I could do this and I could do this well. And I loved it. It just was so much fun to be in front of a jury. So that part was great. I mean, and I knew lawyers who practiced, you know, up until they, you know, their goal is to, you know, drop dead of a heart attack in the middle of a closing argument or something. Not exactly what I ascribed to. So it wasn't the work itself, because I did love what I did, and you know, was proud of it, and proud of my profession, as I said earlier. but one thing I began to realize more and more, and that is that most of my days, it's not like you're in front of a jury every day. You know, those are the exceptional days. Those aren't the routine days. And the routine days, and this is true of most lawyers, and it's sort of a sad comment on the profession. Most of my days were spent sitting at a desk, staring at a computer screen. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, sometimes interacting with it, but nonetheless, sitting at a desk. And I got to a point where I realized that. This wasn't healthy, you know, for me physically, not healthy, and that I couldn't continue. And, you know, people say, oh, well, you could go to the gym, you could get up, you could. Well, I know that I could, but I also know that that wasn't something I was ever. I mean, I'd had gym memberships over the years, but, you know, basically it was just a place to throw money away.
Right. You pay your monthly punishment for not going to the gym.
Yeah, exactly. So I knew realistically, you know, oh, I'm not going to change my lifestyle in that way. As long as I'm practicing law, because, you know, you just, you get absorbed in the work and you know, you don't think, oh, geez, I should, you know, go run a mile or something. So I realized that it wasn't healthy for me, and I needed to address that. You know, I am getting older. So that really was the impetus, you know. And so I finally made the decision. I started winding down my practice, and I kept trying to get out, but finally I was able to in January. I ended my last case. I got that moved on, and I was finally able to. Well, my sister's an Uber driver. My sister lives in Somersworth, and she'd been Ubering for a little bit, and so she says, "Oh, you should try Ubering," you know. And I'm like, "Really?" She said, "Yeah, you might like it." And so I looked into it a little bit. I said, "Well, you know, why not?" I mean, the great thing about it is it's sort of total freedom because. You know, you do it when you want to, you don't when you don't. You know, it's not like, you know, you work for a company, you got to go in, punch a clock, or you got to be there this, you know. No, it's turn your app on and you're Ubering, turn it off and you're not. That's as simple, it literally is as simple as that. So I said, well, okay, I'll try this, you know. So I did, and I found that, you know, I kind of enjoy it. And I also look at, particularly living in Portsmouth, I look at a certain part of it as really providing a service to the community. So I tried it and I kind of liked it. And, you know, I'm a bit of a night owl, you know. I'm usually up late anyway. And my wife, as she says, turns into a pumpkin at 9 o'clock. So she goes to bed early. And so, you know, I'm up. So what are my choices? Well, my choices are, you know, I can watch TV till the wee hours of the morning, or I can drive. I mean, I like driving anyway. You know, driving is something I've always enjoyed. So that was never an issue. And so I tried it, enjoyed it, found it sort of fit my natural cycles in terms of, you know, the most benefit I can be happens to be when I'm there anyway. So anyway, it just seemed to fit. And and there are times when I just don't do it, and I won't do it for days because I'm doing other stuff. So it's pretty, you know, it's pretty good. Actually, I was thinking about, you know, when we finish here, on my way home, I'll turn on the app and see what happens. So that's the whole Uber thing. You know, it's a lot of my riders will ask me about it, and I'm like, well, you know, I'm not sure it's a way to make a living. But, you know, on the other hand, if you enjoy driving and, you know, it's you know, you get to meet people, and of course for me a great part of my Ubering is my music. You know, I have my playlist, and so I'm just absorbed in my music. You know, whether I'm with a ride or not, and you know, which is great. So it's fun.
Cool.
I view it as fun. So that's the Ubering thing. Standing Rock. That was quite the experience, and it's interesting because a lot of people that I now have contact with through social media, which I've never really been much of a participant in, I now have a lot of contacts through social media, and primarily it's because of Standing Rock. But so I had been working, actually. One of the things I had, as I geared my practice down, as I had become, I had worked for Hillary Clinton's campaign got very, very much involved. I mean, I worked every day for the campaign for probably the last 6 months of the cycle. So that had been my focus. And of course, that did not turn out as one had hoped, although I have to say that I was very proud of Portsmouth. She not only won all five wards, but the least, the lowest percentage of votes she got in any ward was 75%.
Yeah.
So I felt that my efforts, along with many other people's, not just me by any means, that our efforts made a difference,
yeah.
You know, and which was what I was trying to do, you know, and the fact that that New Hampshire, although by a slim margin, she won New Hampshire, I felt like, okay, we
Well, that's just because of all the people we busted from Massachusetts.
So on the one hand, I felt proud of New Hampshire. I felt proud of the people in New Hampshire, you know, and I'm like, you know, where the hell were all those people in Michigan and,
right.
and you know, whatever, you know, what are you people doing? You
yeah.
know? It was very, anyway, it was sad. The election results were very difficult. And I really wasn't, you know, I was thinking about the whole retirement thing. I really hadn't. And I saw a letter that a young woman who was related to my wife's family, I can't remember, like a distant cousin, she had posted something, and it was about Standing Rock. And it was something about, you know, are you thinking about going to Standing Rock? And if you are, here's what you need to know. And it was amazing. I mean, it really broke things down, and it talked about, first of all, if you're going to go, you need to know this about staying. So it gave you a lot of information about sort of what the scene was, and also talked about, here's what they need. Mm. And there were like 10, skills or abilities or knowledge or whatever that they listed that, would be helpful, and so that if you had one of these 10 things, then it might be reasonable. And what it was also doing was sort of discouraging you from going to, you know, oh, let's check out the Burning Man Festival kind of thing. You
right.
know, it's like, no, that's not what this place is about. You know, don't go there just to go there. You know, and so I looked at this list, and of the 10 things on the list, I had like 6 of them at least, you know. I mean, one of the, you know, they were looking for lawyers, you know, people with legal knowledge, and particularly criminal law. I'm like, you know,
got
check
it.
That one
yeah.
off. Well, one of the other things is they were looking for people in media. Well, a friend of mine had Nancy West. I don't know if you know Nancy, okay. but anyway, she had for many, many years been a reporter with the Sunday News, New Hampshire Sunday News, which was the union leader's Sunday paper. And so, of course, over the years, you know, particularly when I was county attorney, you know, I got a lot of coverage. So, I've known her for many, many years because she used to cover a lot of criminal issues and, you know, would either call me with questions or whatever. Anyway, so I got to know her over the years and really had a lot of respect for her as a journalist and so forth. So anyway, so she had left that part of her profession and started this thing online, like an online news service, sort of like an AP, only online and more local in terms mm-hmm. of its approach. So called In-Depth NH. So I got in touch with her and I said, look, will you give me credentials if I go to Standing Rock, you know? And so she said, well, of course I will, you know? So she gave me the credentials, to be a media person there. And I'm sort of a amateur. I mean, I have a wonderful camera that I actually got from my practice, but, so it's a good camera and I shoot a lot of photos, wherever I go. But anyway, so I figured out, okay, I'll bring my camera. So then I go down the list and this thing's about, you know, construction skills and, you know, I've worked with my hands throughout my life. I was a woodworker. As I went down the list, there's all these things. And as I said, there's about 6 or 7 of the things. I said, okay, you know, I can do this, you know. And so then I talked to Kathleen. I said, I'm thinking of going to Standing Rock. And, and I told her, I said, you know, I just feel compelled to go. And I can't, I don't know why I feel compelled to go. I just feel this is something I should be doing at this point in my life. You know, I mean, what else? I had to, as I said, a couple of cases. So I had to get back for some hearings. So I knew I would only be there for not a huge amount of time. And, of course, it's getting closer and closer to the winter had already set in out there. And and it talked about, you know, understanding I'm a hiker and I had gotten training with the Appalachian Mountain Club on winter hiking and stuff. So, you know, I had a lot of survival skills and I had a lot of knowledge about all of that. And I knew the clothing and the gear to bring and that sort of thing. So I thought, okay, there's another thing to check off. And so I decided I'm going to go. And it was just an amazing experience. I mean, even the trip out there, just the drive out there. First of all, I couldn't believe how far it was to drive. It didn't look that far on the map. But and I had never been to the – I mean, I've done a lot of traveling over the years, but I'd never been to the Dakotas. Mm-hmm. I'd never been to that part. I'd been to Minnesota many, many years ago. And, of course, I went to school in the Midwest in Indiana when I was at Notre Dame. So, but that particular area, you know, sort of the high prairie area, I'd never been in that. I'd never seen buffalo live before. I mean, other than in a zoo or something, right. But not sort of, you know, oh, out there in the field, yeah. There are the buffalo. And I didn't know, admittedly, did not know, still don't in many ways, did not know a lot about Native culture. But my wife and her family have some Native roots. She actually spent, as a teenager, some time on the Rosebud Reservation, which is where her Native American ancestors were from. Which is the same area, actually, although we were a little bit north of there. But anyway, so I decide, okay, I'm going to go in some ways see what this is about and see what, you know, perhaps I can learn and perhaps participate in, you know. And, of course, you know, initially, you know, child of the 60s and all of that, I'm thinking, oh, okay, you know, well, I'll go to the protests and I'll, you know, stand up for this, that, and the other thing. But then I arrive at Standing Rock, and first I was shocked or stunned by the size of it. I mean, this was incredible. I mean, there were thousands of people at Standing Rock, and so you get there, and I arrived at about I probably arrived like around 5 in the afternoon. It's getting close to, and this is November, so it's getting close to sundown. Mm-hmm. The sun's going to set pretty quickly here. And, you know, I just arrived, and it's like it's a huge area. You know, and there's all these campsites, and there's teepees, and there's tents, and there's other kinds of a few little kind of building structures. Not really sure what's going on. So the first thing I had to do was check into the media tent, get my credentials there, which I did. And then I also went to the legal tent because I thought, oh, I can volunteer, you know, whatever. Which turns out that wasn't entirely true, although I did apply. But they wanted you to apply before you arrive. And none of the lawyers that were there were members of the bar in North Dakota. So they couldn't appear in court for anyone, but what they did provide were tremendous services, and they were a link between the people at the camp and members of the bar, whether they were public defenders or private attorneys or whatever. So I had signed up, but it takes weeks to get approved for that. And I was originally looking to be there for maybe 3 weeks at the most, but ended up slightly less than that, but I was there for quite a while compared to most. But anyway, so the next morning I go to I sort of get the information about that, get my basic credentials. And the main point of the credentials was it allowed me to take photographs in places where other people without credentials weren't allowed to take photos. That was one of the big things. So, I sort of, you know, make do for the night, you know, wait for the next day. And so the next day I go to orientation, which was fantastic. And there probably were 250 people that had arrived the day that I arrived. And what I realized is this is what happens every day. This mm-hmm. is how many people are arriving at this place. Of course, there are also people leaving. So, you know, but there are thousands of people there. And I'm like, oh my God. And the orientation was great, and they stressed, you know, certain things that were important and the reasons for being there. And, you know, there are things that they, you know, that you were welcome to be there if you could identify with some of these reasons. You know, and they would say things like, hey, if, you know, if you're here for the experience, please leave. You know, this isn't about you having an experience. So there were several things that they wanted you to do. One was to learn about indigenous culture, native culture. They wanted you to learn about that. They wanted you to respect it. They wanted you to not assimilate, but to understand what their culture is about. The other thing that they stressed is that the camp, this is the, which is what they called where they were located. They wanted you to understand that this is a prayer, a camp of prayer, you know, which was for me, as an agnostic, a little, you know, this wasn't, my strong it's not really in my wheelhouse.
This, was not on the to-do list.
Yeah. So I'm like, wow, okay. And they wanted you to respect their ceremonies and their, you know, what they're about there. And the other thing that they stressed, excuse me. The other thing that they had suggested is one of their values is to be of use. And when I heard that, I'm like, aha, okay. And of course, being of use, does not mean imposing your ideas of how things should be.
Right.
Being of use doesn't mean, oh, you know, I'll, you know, make this speech or I'll do the. It means if you go to the mess tent and there are dishes that need to be washed, you wash the dishes, you know, you rinse them, you dry them, you put them away. If you see, if you see that the wood stove is going down and you're in a tent or in a dome, you feed it or you bring in new wood or you do whatever needs to be done to benefit the community at large. And that's what to be of use was all about. It was doing whatever it was, and it didn't matter how menial or how significant the task was. You applied yourself in ways to be of use. And that was ultimately, for me, the thing that was the most appealing in terms of where I felt I can do that, you know. And I, you know, during my stay there, I sort of got attached to this one particular structure, which was a geodesic dome where we would have, there'd be morning meetings. There would be ceremonies that would be performed. It's where you would get information about what was going on for the day, or people would be enlisted for other activities going on throughout the camp. And, excuse me. there were like the lighting within the dome was run by this battery of solar panels outside, as well as a couple of very small little wind generators. And so I got involved in making sure that that system kept working, and I actually got trained about, you know, how solar panels work, and the whole, it was actually quite fascinating. There also were wood stoves, a couple of rather large wood stoves that were made out of barrels, steel barrels. And we had a problem once when one of them started leaking smoke into the dome, which is not a good thing. So, you know, like it, 1 o'clock in the morning, we're tearing down that stove. We're installing another one on the other side. We're, you know, So I kind of got involved in helping to maintain the dome, and plus that was also where there were daily press briefings. So I also would, you know, use that part of what was going on. But and I also realized that the whole, of course, the focus of everything was the pipeline. But many of the and they didn't refer to anything as a protest. These everything was about protecting the water. Right. Water. They refer to themselves as water protectors.
Yeah.
So these actions is what they would refer to them when they would have what we might refer to as protest activities. And not all of it was on site. I mean, not everything that they did was out at the pipeline itself or at the bridge, which was really the primary locus. And the day that I got there was the day after the young woman had lost her arm because of the smoke grenade. Well, I don't know if it was smoke or concussion grenades that the sheriff's department had used against a group that had been protesting. So people were, when we got there, people were still talking about, very upset about this whole thing. And of course, the media was being given a lot of false information about what had happened the day before and everything else. Now, one of the things that I observed, with one exception, was that the people who were trying to direct or I don't want to say in charge, because they didn't sort of have traditional structures that what I would call Western structures and hierarchies and chain of commands.
Right.
You know, the things were done far more by consensus of the tribes. You know, and this, I mean, one of the things remarkable about Standing Rock is the first time that all the tribes, I think it was seven tribes, that met together since the Battle of the Little Bighorn. Which, by the way, they referred to as the Battle of the Greasy Grass. So that was their name for it. But anyway, so it's the first time. So there was the Council of Elders that, you know, everything sort of went through, and they were on some level ostensibly in charge. But, you know, wasn't hierarchical or authoritarian in the sense that people were ordered to do things or not or whatever. So it was, and in some ways it was hard to describe, you know, and in some ways difficult to get a handle on how decisions were made or whatever. But nonetheless, you would get informed about what was in the council thinking. But they would also have actions not at the site, and the site was very close. It was literally a couple of hundred yards from the camp. But they would also do actions outside. They'd do actions in Bismarck, which was 45 minutes to an hour away, and also a town called Mandan, which is right next to Bismarck. And one of the early mornings, one of the first mornings I was there, I remember I was ended up sleeping in a tent that somebody said, because I was sleeping in my car and somebody knocked on the tent and said, "Hey, sleep in this tent. You can sleep in this tent." And it was like a large, almost military tent, wooden floors, everything else. There were stoves inside. So I said, "Oh, okay." So I went inside, you know, slept there. Well, early in the morning, I don't know how early, maybe 6 o'clock, somebody's coming through the camp with like a bullhorn and a drum or whatever. And there's a group, you know, and they're like, "You know, meet at the South Gate, meet at the South Gate. You know, there's an action in Mandan. Meet at the South Gate." So I'm like, there's an action. Okay. So I get up, I get down to the South Gate, and we're driving. We're going to have a caravan to Mandan, and we're going to have this this action. So, and it was, and I had driven there. So I had my car, and because it's filled with a bunch of stuff. But anyway, but this young couple that was had met at the South Gate, they were like, you know, can we ride with you? And I said, yeah, sure. So these two young people, we drive to Mandan. And so this action starts, and they're putting tables out in the middle of the road, and they're and people are carrying these signs. And I look at some of the signs, and I'm like, wait a minute. This is not what I signed up for. This is not good. I don't know why this is happening, but this is not something I'm comfortable participating in. And I sought out the, after some confusion, because the whole scene was a little chaotic, I sought out the two people I had given a ride to. And I said, look, I want to show you some of these signs here. And, you know, I'm not comfortable. I got to tell you that this isn't, I'm not comfortable being here, and I'm going to head back to camp. You know, do you want to ride or do you want to stay and participate?
What did the signs say and what were they?
Well, I don't really want to get specific about what the sign says.
What was
says.
The action that you didn't feel comfortable with?
It was suggesting violence towards, I guess, what one might consider the opposition.
Okay.
At least my interpretation is suggesting violence. Somebody might interpret differently. But I was not comfortable with the message and was not something I wanted to participate in. And I did not see it, frankly, as the message of anything I was learning at camp. So I found these two young people that I'd come up with. And I said, look, I want to show you this. And, you know, I'm leaving. Happy to, you can ride back with me or, you know, whatever. And when they saw the signs, they said, oh, absolutely. We don't want any part of this. So, and they had been involved. I think the thing, they had been involved in building some of the shelters back at the camp. They'd gotten involved in the crews that were doing that. So, so we drive back and that, well, later, of course, we learned that this was not an action that had been sanctioned by the elders. And in fact, the elders were rather upset about it. There was a group, I think they were called the Red Warriors, which is a group of younger indigenous members of the community, and they had some different views than the messages that the elders were trying to convey. So this was not a sanctioned event. But, of course, you know, if you just arrived there and, you know, you get woken up in the morning and you're told that, you know, so... You know, the aspect of sort of the, if you will, the lemming aspect of it, you know, suddenly sort of dawned on me that, and it made me realize I need to be listening more about what exactly people are suggesting and learning more about what is, you know, what is, because this was absolutely the wrong message, you know. And of course, when we were in Mandan, I had gone into a convenience store for something, I can't remember what, but there was this woman inside who was just screaming at these people. And she was obviously like a local person from Mandan, and she was screaming at them and complaining about the whole, what was going on at Standing Rock and these people blocking the roads and just the most vitriolic language. And I'm like, oh, you know, so I was a little taken aback at that. And I realized that, hey, you know, not everybody in this community, you know, this community is not all, in fact, there's a lot of resistance within the community, local community, about what's going on. So that was sort of, you know, something to learn. So then later, of course, I realized that this was not an act that the, you know, so there were elements within the population that did things that were counter to the real focus and the mission that that the elders were promoting and the whole reason for being there. And of course, you know, also learned later that, you know, a lot, but there were people there that were literally infiltrators that were paid by the oil company and sheriff's department and so forth to either foment you know, some type of unrest within right. the group, but also to find out what was going on and to report back, which became apparent with the next action I went to, which was a sanctioned action that occurred in Bismarck, and I'll get into that in a moment. So anyway, so early on, that was kind of an interesting thing to learn, you know, and I'm like, okay. The other thing is that, you know, we would have these meetings, and this these morning meetings where they would present sort of things that are going on that day and things that were needed or whatever. And so they might say, oh, you know, we need, I mean, and this whole area was amazing. I mean, there was a whole medical section, for example. There were medical tents. I actually went on a couple of occasions. You know, it was like a city. You know, but a city of like teepees and tents, yeah, and
a pop-up city,
exactly. But of thousands, I mean, yeah, that was the thing. I mean, just the food alone, the amount of food, you know, because there'd be these mess tents that you'd go to, and you just go and you get in line and you get fed, you know, and it was amazing. And I brought a lot of food stuff with me to donate, which I did, you know, like my second day there. And it was amazing the amount of food they had. In fact, they had so much food coming in that they began to distribute the food to some of the local the towns of indigenous populations. And at one point, those communities had too much, and they had to say, stop sending us food. I mean, wow. it was amazing what the whole logistics of the place was something to behold. It really was, it was amazing. So the next action that I went to was in Bismarck, and this one was completely different, and it was sanctioned. It was like, okay, and this was a prayer action. So what they were going to do is we were going to go to this mall in Bismarck, and right outside the Target store, because apparently Target had been supporting DAPL, and which is the Dakota Access Pipeline.
Right.
So we were going to do a prayer circle just outside of the Target store, within the mall, but outside there, because there was a large area. It was just going to be a prayer vigil. And I think it was actually going to be silent, as I recall. And so they were urging people to, we weren't doing a caravan. It was like, get yourself there, and this is the time to be there at the mall and so forth. And this is what we're going to do. It's only going to be like 15 minutes, and then we're going to leave. So a silent prayer vigil, you know, as a protest. And so I make my way to Bismarck, and I get there a little bit early. And I go into the mall. I'm kind of just checking the scene out, getting the lay of the land, everything else, kind of walking around. And all of a sudden, I start seeing all these security and law enforcement people, and they all have these loops on their belts, like bundles of, you know, like electrical tie downs or whatever. You know, I'm sure you've seen these plastic. Yeah. They're the purpose of them is handcuffs, but they look like, you know, ties you use for electrical cords. And they had like just, you know, bundles of them all over their belts. And there were dozens of these groups of security people.
Yeah. So they were completely prepared.
So they knew exactly. Yeah. And they didn't sort of start to appear till about, you know, like if we were supposed to meet at noon, it was probably about 4:15. They just start appearing. And of course, they all go down sort of towards the time. So then people start arriving and they're just forming a circle. And all of a sudden, a guy comes out from Target, some spokesman or whatever, says, oh, you can't be here. And somebody says, we're just here to pray, and, you know, we'll be done in 15, you know, it's just 15 minutes. He says, nope, can't do it. We don't allow any religious events or, you know, in the area. And now, bear in mind, this is, you know, this is late November. I can't remember if that was before or after Thanksgiving at this point, but, you know, it's right around Christmas. So the mall's all Christmassy and everything else. And so these security people start just grabbing people, and, you know, ordering people to do this, that, and the other thing. And now what was interesting is there were other people in the mall. I mean, it was, you know, Christmas time at the mall, so it was fairly busy. And there was a group of people that were like supporting the protesters, which was sort of in contrast to what I'd seen the day before. And they were, people had their cell phones out because everybody's filming everything. Then the police start, or the, whoever they were, whether police, sheriff, security, whatever they were, they started yelling at some of the people who were just mall participants, and they were like telling them that, you know, if they film anything, that that'll be deemed evidence and they're going to confiscate their phones, you know, because still they discourage people. so like very quickly, this whole thing like becomes like this, I mean, within seconds, they were like grabbing people and moving them out. So, a few people end up moving outside and on the corner of the street, they sort of do, you know, hold up signs or whatever. And there was actually a very small sort of counter protest. You know, people had American flags and they were, I can't remember what their messages were, but anyway. And that was it. I mean, it really was over at that point. And, you know, so that, and I had not gotten so far that I was in the circle. I sort of laid back a little bit, observed the whole thing, and just got a sense of what was going on at that. So that was the other action that I had participated in. But the rest of the time, it was all about, you know, as I said, being of use, doing whatever every day, getting up and just whatever people needed to be done doing wow. that. And of course this whole thing, like the meetings and the dome and the whole camp itself, they had signs that talked about, this is a camp of prayer and ceremony. You know, two things that weren't, you know, necessarily, within my, normal experience, you
right.
know?
Right.
But, and so every event, everything in the dome, for example, when we'd have the morning meetings, everything would begin with a prayer, indigenous prayer, typically, and it would end with a prayer as well. And just being there and sort of experiencing this and recognizing that this literally is what they were about there. They were about prayer and ceremony. And there was also a fire, and they claim that what they call that fire, they had a name for it, and unfortunately I'm forgetting a lot, but that fire is the same fire that that they keep burning and has been for, I don't know, decades, centuries, I don't know how long, but from their ceremonial fires. And so that would go. So there was this one ceremonial fire area where, which was outside, where, you know, almost 24 hours a day. Not quite, because at some point people leave, but somebody keeps the fire going. I don't know how, and there would be things going on there, different ceremonies that would take place there. And so anyway, it was just amazing to be there
yeah.
and to participate. And just as I sort of felt compelled to go without knowing why, the day I left was the day I woke up and said, I need to leave today. Hmm. You know, again, not knowing why. Well, and of course, it turns out that it was a day when a blizzard started. So I didn't get very far. I got just east of Bismarck and got snowed in for 2 days in this motel whose only name was Motel in neon lights with one of the letters out. You know, I thought I'd arrived at the Bates Motel,
the
you know.
Moat.
And so that was sort of just physically was an incredible experience to sort of deal with, you know, the weather there. Of course, I'm from New Hampshire, so it's not, you know, it's not like I was from Alabama and never seen snow or anything else. But, you know, the wind there just comes off and just goes across those prairies. And it was something else. But the whole experience, and, you know, and there were people there. You know, of course, there were people from virtually every state, I think. I mean, it was amazing where people came from. And of course, some people showed up, and you knew that they were not prepared to deal with the weather. You know, and of course, you know, I knew from my experience in the Whites that you know, hypothermia doesn't take long for hypothermia to kill you, really. You know, if you're not prepared, and you know, people didn't have the right clothing or whatever. But of course, you know, there were sleeping bags they would give you. There were, you know, clothing they would get. I mean, it was truly amazing how prepared the organizers were in terms of dealing with it. So,
well, I admire you very much for going and doing that, and I think a lot of people probably feel that way too.
Well, I was really surprised at the reaction, you know, because there were many ways in which I just viewed it as a very personal thing I was doing, but then. I did recognize ultimately that that it certainly was much more than that, and that there I was I was very humbled by the reaction that I got from many people who did, as I say, you know, my social media went from like, you know, five people I knew to, you know, I don't know, hundreds of people who seemed to be touched by the events at Standing Rock. And you know, it took on a much larger meaning for me than I anticipated or had. People were very generous and very. Anyway, I was very grateful for the amount of interest that people seemed to have in it. So
yeah,
that's great.
Well, so we've run a little long. So I'm just
sorry.
No, it's all been amazing.
You know, I used to have a motto as you know, have mouth will travel. That was my motto.
All right. So I'll just ask you one sort of question in closing.
Sure.
Which I ask everybody, if you could do one thing every day forever, what would it be?
If I could do one thing forever, every day.
Or
do
if,
one thing
if
every day.
One thing you could do every day forever, what would it be?
Well, it would be of use.
Yeah.
You know, it would to be of use. That's what I would do. Something that is useful to something outside of myself.
Yeah.
Something that helps, assists, aids, whatever, another human being, another being. Something that helps someone else other than myself. That's what I would do. That's what I hope I do.
Yeah. Well, it seems like you've done a lot to point in that direction.
Well, one hopes.
Lincoln, thank you for coming over.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. Really, I've enjoyed this.
Good.